is The Guardian. I'm Jo Tovey, and this is the Full Story Newsroom Edition. Well, it's been less than 2 weeks since the Redbridge poll put One Nation's primary vote ahead of both the Labor government and the coalition opposition for the first time. It marked a new level of popularity for a party that has sat at the fringe of Australian politics for decades and sparked a flurry of questions about whether Pauline Hanson could actually become Prime Minister. So ahead of her first appearance at the National Press Club next week, another first, we're going to break down the changing way the major parties and the media are grappling with One Nation. Will all of this newfound attention lead to more scrutiny? And does it even matter to their supporters if One Nation policies don't always stack up? With me today is Mike Tisha.
Hey, Jo, great to be back talking about One Nation once again.
And Patrick Keneally.
Thanks. Yeah, you just put me on a loop about One Nation, I think.
And joining us from Canberra this week, we have Chief Political Correspondent Dan Jervis-Barty. Hi, Dan.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
So a couple of polls now have put One Nation ahead of both Labor and the Coalition on primaries. Is it credible, therefore, to say that they are in an election-winning position, Patrick?
This is a difficult one to answer because you don't want to rule them out initially. The polling has been incredibly strong for One Nation and has moved very rapidly. But we do also need to put caveats on that. To win, they've currently got 2 seats in the House of Representatives. They'd have to win 74 seats to get a majority in the House of Representatives. That would require, you know, finding 150 candidates around Australia, vetting them, funding them, getting the volunteers to hand out. Like, it is an absolute mountain to climb. And I don't think at this stage we should treat it either a fait accompli or even as something which is likely at this stage. I think if you look back, you mentioned the polling, the Redbridge poll in particular. They did an MRP poll that looks at seat by seat results. In that poll, they found the most likely outcome would be, based on current polling, would be 76 seats for Labor. So still a Labor majority, but by just 1 seat. One Nation would be left with 53 seats and the coalition around 12. So that's not a majority position. So talk of Pauline Hanson as Prime Minister is probably unlikely, but that doesn't mean that we're not in for like a very, very
dramatic,
massive changes, completely upending the table of Australian politics and turning things around. That's a credible possibility, but it's not a binary choice here. There could be many, many different outcomes. We're still 2 years for an election. I don't think we should be ruling it out entirely, but also we need to understand the kind of environment it's happening in.
It's way premature to talk about whether she should become the Prime Minister or not, but I do think it's very fair to examine One Nation as a potential party of government, given that polling position, and they can't say they're not. She seems to have been hedging around that a bit because they don't like to be seen as the potential government because they have that kind of insurgent anti-establishment focus that is so appealing to a lot of their voters. They want to upturn the whole thing. But when you're ahead in the polls, you kind of have to present yourself as an alternative government, even if the chances of it happening, as Patrick, there are lots of logistical hurdles before that could happen.
I think Pat touched on a critical point, the fact that we're 2 years away from an election. It's significant for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it gives both of the parties time to develop a policy response to One Nation, also a messaging response, but also, and you speak to pollsters and people in political research who make this point, is what we're seeing right now in the polling numbers is a signal. It's a very loud signal about where the electorate is at, but it's not necessarily an intention of how they are going to vote. And look at what happened at the last federal election. If you look at the polling through December 2024, January and February of 2025, Peter Dutton was leading in the polls. And then the election campaign starts and it becomes a very different question for voters to try and answer, the question of not sort of how are we feeling, but who do we want to run the country? And I think that's the kind of silver lining that the major parties, certainly the government, are holding on to, is that when it becomes a question of who do you want to lead the country, it's going to be a very different discussion around Pauline Hanson than the one we're having at the moment.
On this question of how the major parties are dealing with that signal that you mentioned, though, it's clear that it is scaring them and changing their behaviour. Let's start by talking about the coalition, who are more than 10 points behind One Nation and who clearly face an existential kind of threat at the moment. This week, we saw Tony Abbott back preference deals with the party. And on Thursday, frontbencher Tony Payson went further and suggested a non-compete deal, essentially. So One Nation and the coalition would agree not to run against each other, which was a pretty extraordinary comment to make. Is the strategy from some Liberals here, Dan, if you can't beat them, join them?
Well, I mean, it's remarkable. If we just take a step back, we're not having a discussion around should the Liberals move to the centre or appeal to Teal voters. It's basically how closely they should associate with One Nation. And we've seen the response from Angus Taylor sort of ruling out this idea of carving up seats that Tony Passon had suggested. But it's clear that that's the number one question for the Liberals at the moment, both from the way they talk about policy and the policies they adopt, is we want to send a message to our voters, because there's a clear belief that a large cohort of people that are voting One Nation have gone from the Liberal Party, is they are trying to, you know, they see them as their people. They don't see them as One Nation voters. They see them as Liberals who are taking a bit of a sort of political holiday with another party. And I think that explains a lot of the approach that they're trying to take, certainly with Tony Abbott in talking about preference deals and so on. It's they're trying to tell voters and not alienate them for sort of flirting with One Nation, because they feel like they are Liberals at heart, and that's the strategy they see to win them back. But I think the fact that so much of this discussion is just how closely we want to associate with One Nation.
I don't know what you think about this, Dan, but like, it seems that preferencing One Nation is one thing, but literally standing down for them in seats speaks of a complete weakness and lack of confidence in your own ability to win government.
Seems like running up the white flag, really. Just surrendering. It's interesting. I think just Matt Canavan and the Nationals seem to have taken a slightly different approach to this, and perhaps it's the seats that One Nation would be polling at highest in would be often currently Nationals held seats. Maybe they see it as a different imperative to have to fight them in those seats rather than dividing up the seats between them and not contesting.
And I think if you look at what happened in the South Australian election, where there was a discussion around preference swaps with the Liberals and One Nation. So the Liberals decided to preference One Nation ahead of Labor, but One Nation didn't reciprocate that. They were like, we don't need these guys. They ran open tickets. So I know that Cos Samaras is the pollster from Redbridge has been out today saying, you know, in response to what Tony Passon said, is when you're polling 18%, which is what the Liberal Party is polling at, you don't make offers. You're begging.
Yeah. Not in a strong bargaining position.
Yeah. They're not in a position of strength. And I think the other thing with Tony Passon, in, you know, he's probably got a bit of self-interest here in, he would clearly be someone who'd be vulnerable to One Nation. So having One Nation stand aside would clearly be in his best interests.
It is pretty extraordinary, though, some of the rhetoric. Like, you do hear people, some within the Liberals, some within the sort of more like right-wing commentary space, talking about the coalition and One Nation as if they're sort of already in a coalition. Like, they are the right of politics that needs to stop Labor. They, you know, the distinction between those three political parties and movements is sort of already being muddied and lost, which is a very dangerous thing, as you say, if you are the minority partner in a partnership like that. Mm.
There's been a lot of descriptions of them in some papers as One Nation as being part of the centre, right?
Mm.
If that's where the centre is, we've really come further than we thought.
It is repeated. It was in the papers today again. It was the two parties of the centre right.
Yeah.
Which should be noted as well. Of course, there are some Liberals who've really pushed back on this. Andrew McLaughlin, the moderate senator, James Patterson, was also on radio today suggesting it was extraordinarily premature, saying he wasn't interested in dividing the spoils with another political party 2 years out from the election and hitching our wagon to a brand with all the risks that that entails between now and then, which frankly is pretty common sense stuff, you would think.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the default answer when politicians are asked around preference deals is they say, look, that's a decision for party head office. Well, who's the who's the president of the Liberal Party? It's Tony Abbott, and he's the one that said it quite makes sense for them to do it. So this discussion's not going to go away, and I think it is just a fascinating subplot to what's going on in politics at the moment.
There's a lot of comparisons made between sort of Labor's, how they've benefited from Green's preferences over the years when people on the right are talking about a potential deal, which is true, of course, but you don't see Labor kind of cozying up to the Greens between elections or talking about them like they're in some kind of alliance. In fact, they're pretty pugilistic towards the Greens. Anthony Albanese certainly is. Mm. So there's a lot of difference between the approaches there, I think.
Yeah, it's like a coalition talking point. The Labor and the Greens are one party, but actually it's not true.
Yeah.
They don't, like you say, they don't behave like that in anything like the way that some people in the coalition are talking about it now.
And many people think Anthony Albanese has often been harder on people in the Greens than he has been in the coalition. Just speaking of the government, it does look like they are also starting to take One Nation a bit more seriously, seeing them as a potential threat to their seats, not just to coalition seats. What do you make of the government strategy so far, Dan?
Yeah, I think there has been a shift over the past week. And I think prior to that, the question that a lot of Labor MPs were asking is, well, what is the strategy? It was clear that One Nation had eroded the coalition base, but it was eating up very quickly into Labor support as well. So I think if you look at Anthony Albanese's language over the past week, you can sort of look at it in three parts. He's now acknowledging openly the frustration that Australians are feeling. He's not denying that there is anger out there. He's tying it directly to the actions that the government is taking. So the budget, for instance, with the changes to negative gearing, capital gains tax and trusts, was seen as a direct kind of policy response to address the sort of frustration and disillusionment that people have in the housing space. And then the third part of that strategy is kind of pointing out Pauline Hanson's record and drawing that kind of contradiction in her being the champion of the battlers, but at every point she's been asked to stand up for those working class people in Parliament. She's voted against wage rises and so on. So that third part is going to be a big focus of the government moving forward. Again, I had a conversation with Cos Samaras for a piece that's running on the weekend, asking him, you know, what is the type of messaging that is going to resonate with what he calls red One Nation, so those voters who are Labor that are moving. And he said that the kryptonite for Hanson is a 35-year-old nurse looking down the barrel of a screen telling voters that One Nation is going to damage your pay. That is something that will really resonate with the types of voters that are vulnerable. We've already seen a little bit from Sally McManus, who's the head of the ACTU. So I think it's going to be something we see more and more of Labor is honing in on her record on wages. Now, whether it works, who knows? But I think that's going to be part of the strategy.
I think they definitely need to focus on the economic side of it. Mm. However, I've been kind of fascinated and obsessed, sorry if I keep going on about it to people in this room, with this article in The Atlantic recently that talked about the perma session, not just the vibe session that we've talked about before, where even when economic conditions in the US are objectively good in some ways, not for everyone by any means, but those changes are not affecting what people's mood is. There's a kind of deeper underlying negative, toxic, dragging mood on everything. I do think there's a kind of slow burn to the economic pain that people are feeling. It's not a sudden shock.
Yeah.
It's been a gradual thing that's been going for some years. And A, it's very difficult to address that quickly and make changes to that quickly, but also it's kind of generated, and maybe it's not just about the economy itself, it's about social media and the way people in receiving their politics these days. But there's something more Labor has to try to get at to sort of talk about optimism, talk about sort of drag people out of this really negative feeling that is not entirely attached to their actual economic conditions.
Mm-hmm. There was a similar piece in the New Republic which looked at how people have actually stopped believing that the economy can be good or that they can even be doing well. I thought the line in it, which was really great, was pessimism might be harder to fix than the actual economy itself.
Yeah.
The problem is, though, for Labor, the wealthiest wage earners, like doctors, lawyers, barristers, have actually, their income has increased by 25%, whereas for the bottom, it's 12%. So the top echelons are doing well, but it's not evenly distributed, particularly to the middle class. And I just don't think that you can come out and say, actually, it's your sense of pessimism that's holding us back.
Of course you can't.
How do you spin that message? Real. It's not a good thing. You've just got to think positively about the economy and then everything will be great.
Yeah.
Because what we've seen is like people, even in their 50s, are still paying off mortgages, which their parents' generation basically weren't by that age. Often they'd had 20-year mortgages, they'd paid it off by the 50s, they were starting to feel more economically comfortable. So you have people in their 50s who are paying mortgages, who are under pressure, and interest rates are high. I don't think it's all vibes-based. I think there's actually real pressures on a lot of people out there, particularly those groups that are still raising children, might have aging parents, paying mortgages, all of those
private
things.
Private school fees, cost of living is real.
Absolutely are real economic stresses. I don't mean to by any means to suggest that there aren't. That would be also a terrible political message, obviously, to say what you're feeling is not real. You can't say that. But Peter Beattie, the former Queensland Premier, wrote for us recently about how his government tried to counteract One Nation back in the late 90s and early 2000s. And part of his point was you have to come up with a vision of the future. You have to give people something to look forward to, something credible that we can get to, maybe not in the span of this government or the next government, but I do think that's kind of missing a bit in some of the government's rhetoric, or at least people aren't buying it at the moment.
I don't think anyone thinks this atmosphere around politics is going to change anytime soon. I think One Nation is here for the foreseeable future. Labor has acknowledged the status quo is broken, more or less. Now, how far are they prepared to go in terms of essentially upending the system that they have been so, you know, such a part of, along with the coalition, in sort of managing the Australian economy for decades? And, you know, I think obviously there were significant changes announced in the budget, but I think it's very clear, even, you know, a month out, that they're going to have to go much further in terms of both addressing the problems, whether it's in housing or other issues, but also sending that signal that you spoke about. And, you know, they do it in a kind of patchwork of ways. I think if you look at the bailouts that they've done for industries, whether it's in Gladstone or the steelworks in Whyalla, it's hugely expensive and it's obviously about saving jobs, but it's also about sending signals that, you know, we're standing up for blue collar workers. And how far they're prepared to go, I think, is going to be one of the really significant narratives over the next couple of years.
The other challenge for the government is, and I think it would be a mistake to interpret all of One Nation's rise in support down to economic issues that people are feeling. So much of it is cultural identity issues as well. And I think that's going to be a much more challenging thing for the government to respond on. And I don't see how they're really trying to counter that at the moment.
I just want to move on to the media coverage of One Nation, which I think we have seen a real shift in the last couple of weeks as well. So we're seeing a lot more scrutiny from some outlets, at least, of One Nation's policy platform. Several of their MPs really disassembled last week when pushed to explain their housing policy regarding foreign buyers. The SMH published a pretty scathing piece this week about the actual estimated cost of their defence policy. I'm curious whether the rest of you think this is actually likely to change the way some people who are thinking of voting One Nation may feel about the party, and does that matter?
It definitely matters what their policies are if they're leading in the polls, but I'm a bit sceptical because I don't think people who are saying they're going to vote for One Nation are not looking at their policies and not looking at them really as perhaps as a party of government at the moment. They just want to tear the whole thing down. You know, that's the kind of mood. With one exception, I think, which is immigration, as Patrick mentioned, that's what people understand One Nation stand for. Mm. And there's a strong feeling in favour of that. But on detailed policies on other matters, yes, absolutely, they should be grilled on them. Will it make any difference in the short term, at least, on how people say they vote for them or not? I very much doubt it.
I think it does make a difference, though, when your candidates can't explain the policy. Like, I think you don't want
to... Closer to an election.
Closer to an election particularly, yeah. And when somebody like Barnaby Joyce, who has decades of experience in politics, has done those interviews, an experienced interviewee, he can't explain the details. What's it going to be like when they get these, you know, all these other candidates for other seats? It's not a good look. I think people clock it. I just remember that you know, James Diaz. Like, you'll have 100 of those type of car crash interviews. Mm. It just makes them look amateurish. I don't think it instills confidence in people. David Farley was a fairly experienced, good candidate, really. And he was able to put this case forward. They're not going to find another 100 plus David Farleys. So it is a danger for One Nation.
Mm. What do you think, Dan?
In Australia, there's time and time again, it's been proven that Australian voters are smart and also and I don't say this is a bad thing, but they're selfish. Like, they look at what's offered up at an election by the major parties and say, well, who's going to give me the best for my personal circumstances? And I think when Hanson's policies do come under the scrutiny, again, in that campaign environment, I don't think we're going to see the scrutiny influence the polling or the way that she approaches these things outside of that environment. But once we're in the kind of campaign contest, both the media has honed in on the policies and also the electorate starts asking those questions, then I do think that there is going to be some challenges for her, and we're going to see the impact of that scrutiny and accountability journalism.
I think a good example is migration. So at the moment, One Nation has gone out talking about how they're going to cut migration, but they're not really being asked, what would that do to aged care? What would that mean for health and hospitals? You know, I don't think the consequences...
I think that flags some exceptions, but it's quite unclear how that would work.
It's unclear. So I think there is room for media and for voters to interrogate their policies more and ask, actually, what is the cost of all of this?
Mm. All right, I think it's time for a quick break. But as always, drop us a line at fullstory@theguardian.com. We do want to hear from you. Not just if you have a question for us, but if you or someone you know is thinking about voting for One Nation, write in and tell us why. We'll be right back.